Good morning. It's 9:30 on Wednesday, April 8th. This is a reading of the Green Valley News. Mark DeGroft with you. The Pima County Board of Supervisors okayed a resolution, 4-1 on Tuesday, to reject Trump's executive order regarding mail-in ballots and then called for a judicial review. Supervisor Steve Christie, whose District 4 includes Green Valley, opposed the resolution without any comment. Supervisor Matt Hines, whose District 2 includes most of Suarita, put the resolution forward to oppose what he called federal interference in elections that are duties of states and counties. Trump signed an executive order on March 31st directing the Department of Homeland Security to work with the Social Security Administration in order to create a federally approved list of absentee voters. The United States Postal Service would be directed to restrict mail-in ballot delivery to just those voters. Hines's resolution also said the use of incomplete or mismatched federal databases risk disenfranchising eligible voters, including people with disabilities and those that lack transportation. Board Chair Jen Allen said she's proud of the Recorder's Office and Election Department's work in handling elections in Pima County, saying they work tirelessly to ensure the voters can have the confidence in the system and in its results. She said the county's election workers have done their job against a backdrop of disinformation led by Trump and his allies to overturn the results of the 2020 election. So the bottom line is that the people who brought you the big lie on January 6th want us to believe that they're the ones best poised to run elections, Allen said. And here in Pima County, I think we will have none of that. The Arizona Attorney General's Office wants Pima County supervisors to respond to a state legislator's claims that a resolution targeting immigration operations on county property violates the state's constitution and federal supremacy clause. State Senate President Warren Peterson, a Republican from Maricopa County, sent a letter to Attorney General Chris Mays on April 6 requesting an investigation. Peterson claims Pima County's resolution constructs a countywide discriminatory barrier to federal civil immigration enforcement. The county has until April 17th to respond. Republican State Senators T.J. Shope and John Kavanaugh also signed the call for an investigation, with Kavanaugh telling the Green Valley News the resolution puts the county's state shared revenue at risk. Kavanaugh said Pima County has a right to control its property, but only if its actions don't violate state law. He said that means following requirements for counties and municipalities to cooperate with immigration enforcement. Clearly, restricting immigration officials from entering the property when you don't do that in any other government or private people is restricting, and that is a violation of state law, Kavanaugh said. The supervisors okayed a resolution 4-1 on February 17th that prohibited county departments, agencies, officers, and employees from providing consent for federal officials to access county-controlled, owned, leased, or operated facilities for immigration enforcement without an arrest warrant or other writ that was signed by the state or federal judicial officer. The resolution also bars county employees from voluntarily assisting with federal immigration enforcement activities. A county spokesman told the Green Valley News/Sun on Tuesday that there have been no attempts by the Department of Homeland Security agencies to use county property since the resolution has passed. Supervisor Steve Christie opposed the resolution, along with two other resolutions targeting ICE, which he calls a feckless and worthless exercise. Supervisor Rex Scott told Christie at the time that the resolutions were far from toothless since the board makes policy and provides direction to the county's 7,000 employees. Kavanaugh said he wasn't aware of any county memos telling county employees to ignore resolutions. So I think the employees will take them seriously, he said. So I think they are restricting the enforcement of immigration law. Kavanaugh said he found out about the resolution from news articles on the public vote, saying the Pima County Board of Supervisors was virtue signaling to constituents who don't like immigration enforcement. So, we heard messages too, and it's illegal. If they don't reverse this, then they're going to lose state-shared revenue, Kavanaugh said. County Board Chair Jen Allen said the county had already been giving employees guidance on just how to respond to increasing federal immigration enforcement agents prior to the resolution. Our resolution is a formalization of that. It makes it a lot clearer, a lot more consistent for county employees about what they're really supposed to do, she said. The county has a mandate, right? We We provide essential services that are defined statutorily for the public, and we need to ensure that our property, our services, are ones in which the public can continue to enjoy and participate in and utilize. The legislator's letter asserts supervisors allow any member of the public to walk into county-controlled property while restricting only one group, federal agents conducting immigration operations. He also claims that the resolution's measures prohibiting federal immigration agents from staging on public property creates increased safety concerns. The three legislators also targeted the resolution's requirement for a valid arrest warrant signed by a federal or state judicial officer, claiming federal immigration officers operate under administrative warrants that are issued by the Department of Homeland Security and not under judicial warrants. The legislatures also said the resolution mandates physical infrastructure changes to obstruct federal operation by identifying property likely to be used and posting signs declaring them off-limits and the installation of barriers such as locked gates. Allen first brought the idea for the resolution during the February 3rd meeting, along with discussion for board action opposed to a proposed ICE detention facility in Marana and targeting masked ICE agents from operating in Pima County. The board approved resolutions on all three items on February 17th in 4-1 votes. The board planned to again visit a proposed ordinance banning mass groups with an exemption for law enforcement and military with visible identification. The proposed ordinance has been continued several times to the board's Tuesday agenda, with the outcome expected after the GV News print deadline. The three items put forward by Allen came around following a high-profile federal immigration operations around the nation that led to civil unrest and ICE-involved shootings. Kavanaugh said local police have occasionally broken the law and brutalized people. "Should we prevent local police from parking in our public parking lots?" he said. "These are immigration officers who are legally enforcing the law, and I'm not aware of any incidents in Tucson, so what's their beef?" The county's property resolution states it doesn't restrict or interfere with the execution of lawful judicial warrants or with providing assistance to local, state, or federal investigations that are related to enforcing criminal law. The county's resolution does prohibit voluntary cooperation or use of property for civil immigration enforcement operations. Kavanaugh said he's confident the Mays will stand by the law as the three legislators read it and order the county to rescind the resolution. "If the county supervisors don't want the immigration law enforced against people here legally or illegally, they need to go to Congress to get a change, not undermine it illegally," he said. Allen is confident that the county's resolution is defensible and that state shared revenues are not at risk. "It's not like we're advancing this resolution without doing a legal analysis," she said. "The resolution is fully within our power at the county, and it is providing guidance to county employees, which is our role." One person landed in a hospital after a two-vehicle crash on Sunday night at Rancho Caliente and Rancho Sorita Boulevard, this according to the Santa Rita Fire District. The spokesman said that the T-bone crash in Rancho Sorita occurred about 9:15 in the evening and left both vehicles with heavy damage. One person was treated by paramedics and transported to a trauma center with serious injuries. The Sorita Police Department is investigating the cause of the crash, which took traffic down to one lane. It's 20 minutes in front of 10 o'clock. The Grand Canyon National Park announced the reopening day for an area that experienced one of the largest fires in Arizona's history. The park said that its north rim will reopen on 6 a.m. on May 15th. The north rim was hit by the Dragon Bravo fire, which burned 145,504 acres in the park after lightning started it on July 4th of 2025. It continued to burn until it was 100% contained by late September. The North Rim partially reopened in the same month but closed again on November 14th. The reopening date was based on meeting minimum operational and safety conditions following the Dragon Bravo fire, so Joelle Baird, who is a spokesperson for the Grand Canyon National Park. She said this included ensuring access, basic sanitation, emergency response capability, and overall visitor safety. "Ongoing assessments of post-fire hazards, such as debris flows, hazard trees, and infrastructure stability also inform the timing," she said. answering the center squares questions by mail. The National Park Service is taking a phased approach, reopening what is safe and feasible while continuing recovery efforts. She noted the number of visitors going to the North Rim is to differ from peak fire levels due to limited services and an increased focus on day use opportunities. And while the North Rim remains a highly valued destination, reduced amenities and infrastructure will likely influence visitation patterns this season, she said. Before the Dragon Bravo fire, the North Rim saw 500,000 visitors yearly, which accounted for about 10% of the park's visitors. When the North Rim reopens, its paved roadways will be accessible, allowing scenic drives to Point Imperial, Cape Royal, Roosevelt Point, Valhalla Overlook, and Angel Window. The North Kaibab Trail, which the National Park Service describes as the most difficult of the major Indian Canyon trails of the park, will reopen for foot traffic only. Baird told the Center Square that visitors should expect a limited service environment, including no potable water, fuel, lodging, or consistent power. Access will be phased and some areas may remain closed due to ongoing recovery work or safety concerns. These conditions are directly related to fire impacts and the need to prioritize public safety and resource protection, she said. On top of limited services, Baird also said the visitors will notice significantly fewer services and amenities. The 2026 season will focus on scenic drives, viewpoints, and access to trails like the North Kaibab Trail, but without many of the facilities traditionally available, the spokesperson said. The landscape itself has also changed, offering a visible look at post-fire recovery and new growth across the North Rim, she noted. Baird called the opening in 2026 an important step in informing that long-term vision, with an emphasis on resilience, sustainability, and improved visitor experience over time. The fire has reshaped long-term planning efforts, prompting a comprehensive approach to rebuilding infrastructure and rethinking our visitor services, she said. And according to Baird, this includes planning for replacement of critical utilities, future lodging and operational facilities that will be through a formal planning and public engagement process. Long before Green Valley and Sorita had acres of pecan trees, those fields were home to cotton, alfalfa, sorghum, gayul, barley, and wheat. On April 14th, one of the founders of the Santa Cruz Valley Historical Society will give a unique view of that agriculture past as part of their ongoing History All Around Us speakers series. Oscar Gomez's family moved from a ranch along the Rio Grande River south of El Paso to Suarita in 1950, when he was only 3 years old. Farmers Investment Company's Keith Walden had purchased Continental Farm just the year before. When FICO acquired the Suarita farm in 1958 and 1959, I was old enough to go out there and start chopping cotton and picking cotton for Farmers Investment Company, Gomez said. As I grew up, I did other tasks, irrigated cotton, learned how to drive a cultivator and a cotton picker, and picked cotton during those high school and college years for Farmers Investment. In high school, I learned how to weld, so I spent a lot of my time before I left to go to the Army doing odds and ends and spending a lot of time welding shops. Gomez spent 10 years working for FICO. He spent 2 years in the service, graduated from the University of Arizona, and spent 36 years as an educator, 22 as a middle teacher at a middle school teacher in the Suarita Unified School District. And after retiring, he helped put Friends Together, a 500-page book on the history of the area that was published in 2022. He found himself deeply involved in the Historical Society the following year. The Historical Society is placing historical markers throughout the area, bringing history into schools, preserving oral histories, and trying to digitize community photos, documents, and collect artifacts. The hope is that one day they'll have a museum. Originally, the book was going to be about the oldest school building in the area turning 100, but suddenly they were asked to write stories about themselves and their school years, Gomez said. Then we found out that we wouldn't do any service to the book if we didn't include the community. So from there, we branched off to the community. We started writing about families in the community and some of the history of the community. Once we decided that it was going to be a book, it took us about 6 years to do the whole darn thing, Gomez said. Problem was, he said, he grew up in the area. I couldn't keep my mouth shut. I should have kept my mouth shut, Gomez said with a laugh. Soon he was sharing stories about the gunnery range, the POW camp, and Porter Wilson, the Sorita man who created flag football. Then he found himself sharing many, many of the stories he had heard as a kid while working the land for FICO. He learned a lot from Keith Walden's right-hand man, Warren Toops Culbertson, he said. For example, he learned that Keith Walden decided to switch over from cotton to pecans because spores were causing wilt and rust on the cotton plants. He was also worried about the competition, Gomez said. His best two options were grapes and pecans, and he went towards pecans. One of the positive items about pecans is that they can be mechanically harvested. So in the winter of 64-65, land was prepared before then, and they started planting pecan trees, Gomez said. The first ones that were planted were in the Continental area off a Continental Road, and we call it now the Nogales Highway. That's where La Posada is right now, the Aterian right in there. Now he's sharing all of those written stories during the speaker series. If I talked to any of my former students, they'd say, "We remember all of your stories, Mr. Gomez." And I'd say, "Well, I wasn't you telling you stories, I was teaching," he said. I didn't realize that I had become a storyteller, but all of a sudden it started clicking that was what my elementary school teachers did for us. So if you go, it's the history all around us. Topic is going nuts, the Santa Cruz Valley's transition from cotton to pecans. It's happening at 10 o'clock a.m. on April 14th at the St. Francis in the Valley Episcopal Church, and that's located at 600 South La Cañada Drive, and there is no cost for admission. When Eric Holton, the music director for True Concord Voices and Orchestra, was piecing together the final concert of the season earlier this year, he decided to ask his audiences what they wanted to hear, and they surprised him. It wasn't the songs they chose, but that all three audiences picked the same three songs. West Side Story and the Great American Songbook, a performance by True Concord Voices and Orchestra, is in their season finale celebrating America's 250th birthday. And there are three performances. First one is at 4 o'clock p.m. on Friday, April 17th at the Valley Presbyterian Church in Green Valley. Saturday, April 18th at 4 o'clock p.m. at Grace St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Tucson. And on Sunday, April 19th, the performance in Tucson is already sold out. And if you're interested in tickets, trueconcord.org. Those audiences, including the one in Green Valley, chose from a list of 25 songs that was put together by Holton in line with the season's theme, The American Dream, celebrating America's 250th birthday. The top songs, Summertime, Moon River, and You'll Never Walk Alone. The season finale, including those three and more, comes to Green Valley for one performance this month. About half of the concert, titled West Side Story and the Great American Songbook, focuses on music from the movie's contemporary adaptation of Romeo and Juliet set in the 1950s in New York City. Holton laughed as he recalled how all three audience polls came up with the same songs for the finale. "I was thinking we'd get more than three numbers. Maybe we'd come out with nine numbers," he said. So he filled in with favorites including Over the Rainbow by Harold Arlen, George Gershwin's I Got Rhythm, and Cole Porter's It's Dee Lovely. While most arts organizations struggled through COVID, many shutting down for a year or more or altogether, True Concord Voices and Orchestra barely missed a beat. Holton, who founded the twice Grammy-nominated organization, said not losing momentum paid off with their best-selling season ever this year. The previous ticket sales record was set in 2018 and 19. Strong support from donors and audiences, along with innovations and extra precautions, saw their 2021 season launch months after the COVID shutdown end in the black. True Concord's perseverance was noted in a report by the National Endowment for the Arts, and the group was honored at home with the Startup Tucson Resiliency Award. Holton also attributes the record-setting season to the theme, which highlighted everything from African-American spirituals to folk songs, music that spoke to the heart of the American experience. So what's next? True Concord won't be resting for long after the season finale. They'll be back in the studio in May, tackling unrecorded pieces by William Grant Steele Jr., considered the dean of African American composers. He's got all of these wonderful choral works that nobody knows about because they've never been recorded, Holden said, adding that they've been working with Steele's family and foundation on the project. True Concord has an album coming out this summer, two works by Jocelyn Hagen, one that focuses on the 19th Amendment giving women rights, voting rights, and the other titled The Notebooks of Leonardo da Vinci. In the 2026-27 season, they conclude the theme of the American music with The American Experience, Our Nation Sings. It's really a documentation of the fact that singing and singing folk music and singing masterpieces has been part of our American DNA ever since our founding, he said, adding that 54 million Americans, about one in six, participate in choirs of some sort. We've got a long tradition of great choirs, Holden said, of the United States. Well, for Sarita teenager Chloe Scott, there's more to golf than the scorecard. The sport provides lessons in confidence, accountability, and leadership. Scott is putting those lessons to use on and off the course in her role in the 2026 Leader National Board of Directors. Scott, who is 16 years old, was among 13 girls nationwide that were selected in December as a youth ambassador for the LPGA Foundation by LPGA USGA Girls Golf. I was kind of shocked because 70 applied and then 30 made it to the short list, and that's when you get interviewed, Scott said. I was surprised I was part of 13 out of the likely 30 that ultimately got chosen. Scott's appointment to the national board and her previous experience with the LPGA National Leadership Academy marked the culmination of a journey that began at the age of 12 when she joined the LPGA USGA Golf Girls of Green Valley. The local program for girls ages 6 to 17 is led by Marvel Barnard, an LPGA Professionals Hall of Fame member and the director of instruction at the Country Club of Green Valley. Chloe is growing into a leader right before our eyes, Barnard said. She was a shy, quiet girl who stood in the back when she joined our group. After attending the LPGA National Leadership Academies, she has blossomed. Scott's mother, Mary Ann, had always viewed golf as a rich man's sport, but after learning of the affordability of the LPGA USGA Girls Golf of Green Valley, she signed up Chloe to encourage her to get involved. I didn't know that much, but I'm like, okay, I guess I'm doing this, Scott said. Under the tutelage of Barnard and the volunteers at Girls Golf of Green Valley, Scott quickly took to the game. She saw her confidence grow on and off the course through Barnard's mentorship. She's a really good instructor. She's so encouraging and she sees so much in me, Scott said. I really love how she's always telling me that I can do it every time I go and practice with her. At 13 years of age, Scott joined the LPGA USGA Girls Golf E-Leader Program, a national volunteer and mentorship initiative. In addition to her leadership roles in the local group, Scott assists Barnard by directing traffic and helping the youngest golfers during their lessons. Barnard initially paid her for the help, but Scott eventually chose to volunteer her time to give back to the program. As a veteran member of the local group, Scott now helps prepare monthly events, including a carnival-themed clinic scheduled for April 18th. Chloe's help has been invaluable to me in planning exciting events for our kiddos, Barnard said. She brings concepts and activities she learned at the leadership academies to our girls and also serves as a role model in leadership. She's very creative and thoughtful, and I can't wait for our younger girls to experience the fun program that Chloe has designed for us. For Scott's mom, Mary Ann, the impact of the local group has had on Chloe goes beyond the mechanics of a golf swing. Chloe is naturally really shy, and putting herself out there is really difficult and challenging for her, she said. This has really afforded her the opportunity to explore something that's different and outside of her comfort zone socially, emotionally, and physically. She had this opportunity to jump into this arena and recognize both the mental and physical parts of the game. While Scott is still deciding how far she wants to take her own competitive play, her experience has inspired her to pursue a career in sports psychology to help other athletes navigate the mental side of sports. And while Scott began developing her leadership skills in Green Valley, traveling to the LPGA National Leadership Academy events in San Francisco and North Carolina allowed her to gain independence and move beyond her comfort zone. I'm pretty shy, and in the beginning, I was kind of like in the background and a little nervous. But by the end, I really started feeling comfortable and confident, she said. I had a lot of fun, and I felt like I stepped out of my shell. Upon returning from her leadership trips, Marianne witnessed Chloe's confidence growth spurts. You just see it in her face and in her eyes, she said. There are people that believe in her, and then she walks away and is starting to believe in herself. That's when I think the world can change and that her community can change. Cott's experience last month at the Founders Cup in Menlo Park, California, served as a pinnacle for her tenure on the board. The tournament honors the 13 founding members of the LPGA, and Scott was there to witness the legacy firsthand. During the event, Scott rubbed elbows with some of the biggest names in the sport, including Morgan Pressel. Now a prominent analyst for Golf Channel and NBC Sports, Pressel famously became the youngest player to qualify for the U.S. Women's Open at the age of 12. It was really cool meeting the people who worked really hard to start things up in golf, Scott said. And while the LPGA founding pioneers dinner, she attended the trip providing historical perspective. She said the true highlights were helping with the golf clinic and navigating it all independently. She also had a memorable encounter with 23-year-old Australian professional Cassie Porter. After following Porter for several holes, the golf pro golfer took notice. Halfway through, she noticed that we had been watching her, Scott said. She offered us water, and a few later, she offered us water again. And when Scott and a friend waited near the autograph table at the 18th hole, Porter sought them out. She waved at me and my friend over, Scott said. We went over and she signed us a ball. It was just really cool. And for Bernard, seeing Scott navigate the tournament was a full circle moment that validated the mission of the Green Valley program. So is the Green Valley News for this Wednesday. Mark DeGroft with you. Thanks for coming along. We'll be back on Friday, and until then, take care.